You wonder what the Holy Grail is. Have you ever wondered? Yeah, me too. Have you ever wondered if it's actually a real thing? Yeah, that too, right? Both of these questions are up. We're going to explore a little bit. In Celtic stories, and then also in Christian stories, there is this idea of the Holy Grail that is actually named what it is. They say that it's the chalice that Jesus and his disciples drank from at the Last Supper. Also, it's said that that chalice was used to collect the blood of Jesus at the crucifixion by Joseph of Arimathea. Then there was a lot of books and writings and ideas that culminated with the popular Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown. Remember that one? Not too long ago. And he said that the Holy Grail was not an object, but the womb of Mary Magdalene that carried the bloodline of Jesus and Mary and the birth of their daughter, Sarah. Lots of intrigue, isn't there? But here are some cues or clues. This idea of the chalice and the womb are both receptive, both life-giving. So there must be something about those ideas. And we know in our power of life, in unity, the 12 powers that we studied over the summer, the last power that we talked about was the power of life, right? This idea that spirit's life, that animates our being, it's similar to our passion or our zeal or that which propels us into action, is symbolized by the color blood red. All these puzzle pieces starting to come together, that there is something about the grail that gives life. And maybe that's part of this idea that it is so holy. So the grail has intrigued people for, 1,500 some years, right? We've heard about a lot of the stories over time. People that are real or imagined seeking after the grail, right? There are all kinds of researchers and individuals that look for the grail, and then they say, I think I found the grail, and then there's some kind of cup or chalice that's dated, and they say, well, yeah, it's about the right date, but who knows? Is it the grail? Is it the idea that has been held? You know, you might know the Holy Grail and the search for the Holy Grail by Monty Python. Right? You might know it by Indiana Jones. You might know it by the King Arthur legend. So there are many ways that we have been, over time and story, been introduced to this idea. And among these real and imagined characters, there is this hot pursuit, right? The zealous kind of pursuit for what it is. But before we look at the grail itself any further, I'd like to look at who's looking for the grail. Is the one who's looking for the grail a holy fool, or are they a hero? Because those archetypes are really important. You know, for a long time in our Western culture and still today, many of our stories and our films are based on the idea of the hero's journey. This made popular by the mythology that Joseph Campbell talked about, right? The classic hero's journey. You can look at almost every story, and it shows the trials and tribulations that the hero goes through before they return home triumphant, and they are celebrated for what it is that they found, some kind of holy grail, you know, whether it be an innate characteristic or an object. And so there's this sense, this love affair that we have with the idea of the hero. So the thing about the difference between the hero and the holy fool, actually there are many differences. The similarity is the holy fool too goes on a journey, right? We're talking throughout the series on the path of the holy fool. The holy fool is on a journey that is, of course, full of trials and tribulations and learnings and all kinds of things. But there are several departures then between the hero and the holy fool. The holy fool would never consider themselves a hero. The holy fool thinks of themselves in this very authentic and simple way. I just am who I am, doing what it is that I have come to do. I am nobody's hero, right? So there is that sort of sense of humility and authenticity that's built into who the holy fool shows up as this kind of archetypal figure that we all imagine ourselves to be, hero or holy fool and many other archetypes. So this idea of the holy fool is also the spiritual journey. It's the way the spiritual journey itself is seen. For the holy fool, it's a lighter touch, right? That there's less intensity and more playfulness. So how many of you, I'm wondering, because the point can often get across for the holy fool through the holy fool more memorably because there is playfulness, because there is humor. For example, how many of you have gotten your news of the day from a comedic nighttime TV show? Right? Anyway. So we might kind of laugh like, well, this isn't really the news, but it kind of was the news, and it was funny, right? So thank God there are holy fools amongst us that can deliver that when sometimes we just need a lighter touch, right? So this is something that is available to us. The hero's journey, on the other hand, has more of that intensity, but also is more of an individual quest often. On the hero's journey, there are great feats that occur. Usually signs of strength and endurance, maybe signs of intelligence. Let's take, for example, Professor Indiana Jones. He's a professor, right? So automatically go to academic, intellectual, smart. On top of it, well, besides the fact that he's good looking because he's Harrison Ford, there's another plus in the column of the hero, right? He's also amazing, right? He can do all these physical feats. So he's afraid of snakes, but he has to confront tons of snakes, right? He jumps over these big canyons. He deals with floods. He does all kinds of things in search of the Holy Grail. And this hero then is kind of seen as a savior. Becomes kind of depicted, can be depicted when interacting with others as a sort of savior. So the interactions with others aren't, you know, we're a team, we're in cooperation. It's more, I'm going to swoop in and save. Did you know that Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom was actually banned from India? And the reason why is because there was depictions that they felt were untrue about Indian Hindus, but also there was, especially for this reason, that there was a scene where the Indian village, the Indian Hindu village, the only way that they could survive is if this white Christian hero swoops in and saves the day. And they said, no, thank you. And so they just didn't even allow it in their country. So by contrast, the holy fool knows that they can't effectively act alone, that they're never alone. In fact, they must always be tuned in to the divine within themselves and allow that divinity to be their guide. So there is a constant surrendering of the ego to that which is true and real, that divine self that carries us forward. And secondly, they also know that they don't act alone as an individual human being, but that all life around them is a part of what we collaborate and cooperate with and work together to achieve things. So there is an innate understanding of that, which also lends itself to compassion for one another, right? So there are a lot of things that we begin to unpack when we see how the holy fool moves through life and challenges. There's an honoring of others in their innate divinity, as well as the innate divinity in ourselves. So Parsifal is the holy fool that is talked about in the King Arthur legend and is referred to in The Path of the Holy Fool that many of us have been studying throughout this series. And so Parsifal goes, he's part of his holy foolness, if you will, is that he's teachable, right? He's sort of, you know, he doesn't know a lot when he leaves home. He's been sheltered. And so he's got a beginner's mind. He shows us how to stay open, how to stay curious, how to be willing to receive. And so he's willing to receive advice all along the way. Sometimes to his detriment, he just believes all the advice he receives, right? So one of the kind of bits of bad advice he gets is by somebody who tells him, don't ask questions. I mean, don't ask questions, right? That kind of cuts a huge piece out of our journey of curiosity, which is a part of what this imaginal realm is a part of what the holy fool is. But he's in process, right, of learning, like all of us. And so the first time the Grail castle of his imagination appears, he enters the castle, and there before him, besides the rest of the king's court, is the Fisher King. And the Fisher King is ailing. The Fisher King is got a wound or an illness. And Parsifal sees that he's ill, and his heartfelt compassion begins to open, and his curiosity to inquire after the king's well-being. But he remembers that bit of advice, and he says, oh, I can't ask any questions. It mystifies everybody that Parsifal, the knight who's arrived, who's supposed to, you know, somehow be part of this Holy Grail experience, remains silent. And when he does, the Grail Castle disappears. So he comes back to the Grail Castle later, and we'll pick up his story a little bit later. But I wonder about you. Have you ever overridden your own intuition because you received some advice from someone else? Yeah. Anybody ever do that? Right? This is one of the key nuggets of our spiritual journey, isn't it? Learning to trust our intuition. That nudge that we get, that knowing that we get, we become more versed and more versed in trusting that. Even though we may receive advice from others, we may seek counsel, we may have resources all around us that can be very helpful on our journey, at the end of the day, we have to trust the gut feeling, right? The innate knowing that we have. And that's the journey that Parsifal is on, and I would venture to guess all of us are on to learn more of. Also, that piece of following the heart's natural inclination for compassion. We can tend to cut that off, and of course, when we do, how much is lost, right? For all of us, for all life. And so allowing our hearts to stay open so that we can keep fostering the compassion that is natural to us. So while the hero has been our collective archetype for so long, especially in our Western culture, the time has come, I think, where we are recognizing it doesn't serve us. Maybe it did at some time, but it doesn't serve us anymore. More an archetype like the Holy Fool does. And so this is what we're moving into on our next aspect of our path, the next leg of our journey. So Lauren Artress, the author of The Holy Fool, she speaks about another way that the Holy Fool and the hero differ. In the hero's journey, the hero returns home. There's a home to return to. In the Holy Fool's journey, there is no home to return to. Everything has changed. Sound familiar? Because during this, you know, I think at some point, well, we might even have an era called the PPE, the post-pandemic era, coming sometime soon. Stay tuned. Yeah, we're still waiting for that. But, you know, it's like as we're seeing, as it's unfolding, as it's starting maybe to recede into our rearview mirror, we can see that where we return to is not the same. It may be similar. There might be some similarities, but it's not the same kind of old ways, familiar ways. It's not the same kind of old home feeling. There's changes that have been made in us collectively and individually that just can't make it quite the same. There's changes going on in our earth home that just can't make it quite the same. The Holy Fool has to make friends with this idea that it's not the same old normal, quote unquote, that we expected. And so that's part of the bravery of this journey, really. You know, we always think of the hero as the brave one. Well, who's really the brave one that doesn't have that familiar space? Right, there's a brave one amongst us. Yeah, so this is another reason why we recognize that the timeliness of this archetype is the telling of it is that we must create anew, right? We're in a space of co-creation. We're in a space of creating, in some ways, complete newness, complete freshness, in some ways, just a refresh of what we've known from the past works or doesn't work. So A.V. Loeb is an astrophysicist that is really playing the Holy Fool right now. I read about him in Smithsonian Magazine, and he's really got the rest of the scientific community kind of scratching their heads because he's very well respected, and there's an asteroid that they've been studying in space, but he is saying now it's not an asteroid. He's saying it's something alien. It's an alien or it's an alien object. It's something alien. And the rest of the scientific community is going, oh, what? You know? And this is an example of a modern day holy fool. Somebody who's willing to risk their reputation, who's willing to turn upside down a world that is built on intellect and reason, and to say, imagination matters. The world of possibility, the entering into the mystery, this too is a part of our journey, even a scientific journey. So people like that really allow us, give us permission to enter into the mystery, to bring forth the realm of the imagination and raise it up higher in terms of its importance to how we resolve issues together, how we co-create this new world together. We need holy fools like that in every one of our disciplines. We need holy fools like that, like you, everywhere in the world, to show up that way in your family, in the organizations that you might serve, in the ways that you might volunteer, to spend time. Many of you who have grandchildren or children, you know when you spend time with them, you enter into that imaginative realm. Here's the difference, though, if we stop separating and saying, oh, you know, children are so wonderful because let children teach us to be wonderful, too, to play in that imaginative realm, because we have something special to give when we recognize that as adults, we've got a lot of wisdom, right? We've been through a lot of things as adults, and so we can become childlike again, but with a different kind of wisdom that we bring because of our experiences as adults. All of that is a part of the next frontier. All of that is a part of entering into life and claiming this archetype for ourselves as holy fools. So let's get back to the grail. What is this thing, this holy grail? A holy grail can be many things. So what makes it holy then? What makes it a grail? What makes it holy? You know, on Friday night, the prayer chaplains gathered, often in our training, our traditional way to open is to bring a sacred object and to tell each other about that sacred object. Somebody asked, well, what does a sacred object mean? And I said, it means an object that you believe is sacred, that is sacred to you. And that's a cue into the Holy Grail. It's something that is sacred to us. You could hand me the same object that doesn't have sacredness to me. To me, I might just see the object and say, oh, that's pretty. But to you, it was something your mother gave you when you were 5 and you've carried in your pocket ever since. You know, so that's sacred, right? That's sacred to you. It has connection. It has meaning. It's infused with something holy to you. I can behold it as a holy grail for you, but it won't be the same for me. So a holy grail in some ways is defined by us as holy, is defined by us as sacred. Think about Scripture, for example. Why is the Bible considered holy, or all the world's scriptures considered holy by their adherents? In part, it's because for centuries we have infused energy into this book that says it is holy. We've all decided collectively it is holy, it is sacred. And all that energy, all those years, we've sworn upon it, we've prayed over it, we've drawn from it. It's a place we go back to again and again and again. So scriptures are holy like a grail is holy because we say it is so. And we act as if it's so. And we treat it as if it's so. And we allow it to be a grail, a guide for us, an opening, a chalice, a receptivity, a giver of life, something that propels us forward in life, that engages us with life, that reminds us of who we are, perhaps even. All of those things can come from what we make it. So when we think about this idea of the chalice of everlasting life that is signified by the idea of this blood of the Christ or the blood of the divine, this ongoing life, right? So the life that begets more life, that thing that allows us to feel alive, perhaps, can even be a Holy Grail. So you see, the Holy Grail can be maybe not just one thing, and maybe different for each of us, but still equally honored. And it's something that maybe allows us to go deeper in our spiritual understanding and on our spiritual experience. So I wonder if there might be some kind of symbol in your life that feels kind of like a Holy Grail. Maybe it's a Holy Grail right now. Maybe it's something that's a recurring symbol that I have one that just, you know, has kept coming to me recently that came to me a long time ago. And so lately I'm just sort of holding it with an open hand, knowing that symbol is there. It's just kind of in the background. I get curious about it every so often, but try not to get too head focused on it, you know, and then let it go again. So maybe you have something like that, a symbol that comes to you. That's the language of Spirit. Spirit speaks in symbols to us. This is that place where we tap that realm of imagination. So that may be one way that it begins to open up for you. Ah, this might be my grail. Or maybe it's an activity. Lauren Artress suggests in the book that the grail can be an activity. It can be a spiritual practice, perhaps. Something that is just a grounding, an anchor, a place you return to again and again that deepens your spiritual journey. Artress suggests that the labyrinth itself is a Holy Grail. And if you think about the labyrinth, it has this ancient, powerful energy, right? Labyrinths have been around the world, around humanity, spread throughout the world in different designs for a very, very, very long time. And they've become more popular in modern times, in part because of Lauren Artress and the modern labyrinth movement that she's leading. And by the way, she's our speaker next week, so that's pretty exciting. So you get to hear from the author and this one who's saying about this labyrinth that it could be a Holy Grail. So also the sacred geometry in the labyrinth can allow us to draw from it, to get something from it just by beholding it. We don't even have to necessarily do the meditative walk to draw something valuable from it, because of the symbology, the design, the flow, the ancient energy in it. So I was given a proposal from a friend some time ago and walked the labyrinth to discern my answer. She asked if I wanted to invest in her business. She was just about to start something new. I love my friend. I believe in her. I figured this would be very successful because I know who she is, and I wanted to support her. And so everything looked like green light, right? But something was going, that's not for you. And I also had this sort of like, oh, wow, I'm like such a big girl now. I could invest in somebody's business. You know, that felt really, really prosperous and generous and exciting to me too. So all of those reasons seemed like the right reasons, right? And then I walked the labyrinth because I just wasn't getting a clear yes. And it wasn't too far into the labyrinth. I wasn't even in the center when I felt very, and I was walking this labyrinth, very directed to draw a symbol. And so I drew this eye and then a line through it. And it was drawn through me, I should say. It wasn't like I thought, oh, I got to draw this. It was just like, it just happened through my hand, right? And as soon as I did that kind of a no symbol, right, I knew this isn't for me. And so I was reluctant to call my friend, but luckily she's a spiritual traveler on this path and understands divine guidance and completely understood, no problem. But the point is that we can have these sort of symbolic and mystical experiences with the things that we might consider a grail. So whatever those things are for you, just to begin to ruminate on them a little bit, to ask the question, to inquire within and to see where you might get led by a symbol, an object, a spiritual practice, any of these things. So let's get back to Parsifal. I mentioned that he spent 20 years, so he went to the Grail Castle, he had this sort of failed experience, if you will, with a Fisher King, poof, the Grail Castle disappears, and it takes him 20 more years to find it again. And in those 20 years, of course, he's learning, he's growing, he's becoming more wise, more compassionate, more willing to trust his intuition. He's finally discarded that bad advice about don't ask questions and realized that he must ask questions to get to some clarity. And that it's important not so much to have the right answers, but to carry the right questions. It's the ego wants us to have the right answers, right? To appear as if we're in the know. But the holy fool is always staying open and curious and wondering and carrying forth questions, right? So he returns to the castle. The Fisher King is still ailing. And what this means, too, is when the Fisher King is ailing, the whole kingdom is ailing. And so all the people are sort of, you know, anxious for the Fisher King's healing to happen. This time, Parsifal comes in with confidence, with faith, with trust in himself. He knows not only he needs to ask a question, but he needs to ask the question. And so he asks the question, and the Fisher King is healed in an instant. And therefore, the whole kingdom becomes lighter and brighter and more healthy and whole. So do you wonder what the question is? Yeah, I thought you'd never ask. The question is, whom does the Grail serve? Whom does the Grail serve? Interesting, isn't it? So the point being that the Grail does not serve the king or just the king, it serves the kingdom. That the Grail ultimately serves the divine. So it's important to know that what we do, and this is another big, schism or change in our spiritual paths today. We're letting go of the hero and we're picking up the holy fool. We're letting go of the certainty of home and we're opening to the possibility of what we create in Earthrise together. And so we let go of those old things that we are clinging to, and we move forward into the knowing that we are in service. That our spiritual paths are not about reaching nirvana and bliss and end of game. That was the way that we talked about spirituality for decades, right? That this, it was the idea of transcending the world and getting the goodies of nirvana and bliss. And it was all about the individual solo journey. But no more. It cannot be. It cannot be. Our very existence depends on it. That we recognize the fact that we serve the divine. And when we serve the divine, we serve the whole kingdom or queendom. We serve all, right? We serve all life. That's why it was so important when we created the mission here at Unity of Walnut Creek that It didn't end when we say we're a loving, inclusive community, living, expanding and living our divinity. It doesn't end there. It ends with in sacred service for all. That's the key. That's the key. We can't forget that we are in service to the divine. And when we remember that, don't you feel empowered by that, inspired by that, to know that what you do, how you show up, what you extend to others is in service to all? It doesn't end with us. It's not even just, well, it is about us, but not just us. And so this is such an important piece of where we are now and where we've, I think, turned the corner in our spiritual journeys and beginning to recognize, even for people who may not claim to be spiritual. I mean, I don't know how you can't be spiritual, but you know what I mean. Some of us just can't wrap our head around that. but even if they don't claim it as a being who we know to be all beings, to have this sense of innate divinity, you know, that we all are beginning to recognize, even in these different fields, right? All these different career fields even, and these classic places like business are starting to awaken to these ways of being that we are here to be in service. Everybody might not use the language service to the divine. That's okay. That's our language. That doesn't mean we're going to find that everywhere in the world. But what we can tap into in the world is an awakening. There's an awakening going on. That is super exciting, isn't it? There's a new world happening, it's sort of rumbling beneath our feet. I'm remembering like back in the 80s or 70s, remember Earth Shoes? And that song, I feel the earth move under my feet. So it's not about transcendence anymore. It's about being here, you know, solidly on this planet. To know that we are in service to our planet. When you think about Earthrise, that beautiful image that we talked about, the fragility of what it seems like, the fragility is the life on the planet, right? The precious life that we are. And that there is a sense of responsibility. And that's all part of service to the divine. So we are on an amazing, mystical, magical journey as we step in really fully and own this. I am following the archetype of the holy fool. I've got my holy grail in hand, and I know who I am in service to. And if I forget, the person next to me at Unity is going to remind me, you are in service to the divine. Will you say that to somebody next to you? You are in service to the divine. It's a good thing that we come together here in community, because that's why we do, to remind each other what this life is about, who we are, who we've come to be, what we are up to here. And when we remember we're in service to the divine, isn't that like the most humbling thing you could ever hear? It nearly brings me to tears to think about what we have been entrusted with. The gift that we have been given, the charge that we have been asked to do. We're not just moving through our days. We're living. We're life-giving. We're receptive to spirit. We become like a holy grail ourselves. So we, the holy fools, the holy grails, the ones with holy grails in hand, we are serving the divine by serving all, by stepping in and stepping up. Let's say it together. Let's know it together. Let's go forth on this journey with joy. I invite you to say this affirmation with me. I am a holy fool with a holy grail serving the divine. And so it is.